welcome to UbuDub, and you'll be hearing the interview with Craig Bell from Rocket from the Tombs in just a few minutes, where he talks about that first moment he walked into the rehearsal room all the way through to the last tour that the band did. But I wanted to let you know why it had been so long, and that's because we at the Ubu Project's headquarters have a new project called DPK TV. And we're live streaming 3 weeks out of 3 Sundays out of 4 of each month to our Patreons. And you can find us at patreon.com/pairubu. It's $5, and for that you'll get at least 3 hours of live entertainment from David Thomas and other musicians, with music, archive videos, never before seen live footage, the Cabinet of Crap, which has proven to be quite popular, the Lyric Lotto, and so much more. So please do forgive us the delay in this latest podcast, but come and join us on patreon.com/pairubu and see what we're doing there as well. In the meantime, here's Craig. Craig Bell, what is your earliest music recollection?
I was always a big fan of the radio, so I was listening to the radio since as long as I can remember. And, you know, so it just whatever I could find. I mean, you know, 1950s rock and roll was probably the first stuff that I was listening to music-wise. I was just all over the dial. I used to keep a radio log of stations I could find around the country. So I would listen to anything, country, R&B, small stations, big stations, gospel music, stuff like that. So I was more interested in finding where in America I could find, or Canada, I could, you know, receive a signal from.
Yeah.
And through that, it turned me on to a lot of different kind of music early on. But you know, it's the popular music of the day. The first single I bought was a little pop song called Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini.
Oh, I know it.
And so, you know, from there, that was my first record purchase.
And were your family musical? Was it a musical household?
No, not really. Not really. My mom was a big fan of Sinatra, and she would play his records, and she would play, you know, they had some big band records and things. My dad was into bagpipe music.
Oh.
So, oh, yes. Yeah. So we had that, and but we were all encouraged when we were kids to play an instrument, learn an instrument, learn something about music, through school and stuff like that. You know, we had choir in school, we had choir at the church, and we had took trombone lessons. I took clarinet lessons.
Really?
And they didn't stick.
So when was the first time you picked up a bass?
Bass guitar was sort of handed to me when I met Jamie and Jim Crook and joined Mirrors. They already had two guitar players, and they sort of handed me the bass and said, here you go, figure this out.
Where were you, who were you, and what suddenly projected you into the Mirrors?
I wanted to join a band. I wanted to play in a band since the Beatles, just like every other kid in America. When the Beatles hit, you know, we all wanted to be in bands. Mine was a wee bit different. I actually... my moment was when I saw the Jerry and the Pacemakers movie at the Beach Club Theater in the town next to mine in Rocky River, Ohio, in the summer of, I think it was 1964. Sat through that 3 or 4 times with my friend Dave one Saturday afternoon, and on the walk back home, we both decided, oh, we want to be in a rock and roll band. My only problem was that there was no way, as long as I was living under my father's roof, that I was going to play guitar or have a guitar or anything like that. His idea of all of that was that wasn't real music, that there was none of that happening here. So up until the time I graduated from high school, I would just befriend people who were in bands and stuff like that. I was the guy that was there. Yeah, let me come with you. I'll haul your ramp for you. That kind of stuff. And but once I graduated from high school in 1970, I started looking around to play in a band. When I came back, so I went to California later in that year when I returned in 1971, the Velvet Underground were coming to Cleveland and playing. This was after Lou Reed quit. It was the Doug Yule Velvets. So I went down to the Agora, and I ran into Jim Crook, who I had known from a few years before that. He was dating a friend of mine. His then soon-to-be wife was a good friend of mine in high school. So I knew Jim, and he had just gotten back from military service, and I hadn't seen him for a year or so, and we were talking, and I asked him what he was doing, and he said, oh, you know, me and my friend we're going to start a band. And I said, oh, really? I said, I'd like to get in a band. And we talked some more, and we talked about records and things, and he invited me over to his house and to meet Jamie. So I went over there, brought some records. We spent the day listening to records, and they played us some tapes, and we talked. And after probably a couple of visits, it was decided that I was going to be the bass player. And Jamie handed me a bass that they had. I think it was an old Hagstrom 8-string that only had the main four strings on it. And he showed me how to tune it. And he says, you just got to figure out the rest for yourself. So I just started playing, and we started rehearsing. We played a few times and then decided we needed a drummer. And I remembered a friend of mine from high school who was a guitar player in a band. So why not ask him? So I asked Mike Weldon, do you want to be the drummer in this band? And he says, sure. So he joins the band as the drummer, and off we went.
Wow.
And pretty much learned by playing and listening to other people and things like that. Just picked up what I could.
And did songwriting come easily to you in those early days?
No. No, I made a few meager attempts. Also, I was up against a pretty good songwriter, Jamie Klimek. And he had so many songs. Jim had songs. They had songs they had written together. These guys had been playing together since high school. So my first few years was more like a learning thing. It wasn't really until I came back from my military service, which was from 72 to 74, that I really started writing songs. I had written a few songs before that, but mostly it wasn't until a couple years later that songwriting came to me. And after a few false starts, you know, I would come up with this idea and I'd take it to Jamie and say, what do you think? And he'd just go, no. And so I'd go back and try something else. And finally I came up with this song, Slow Down, which was kind of like a velvety two chord thing, and Jamie liked that, so he worked with me on that song and helped me develop it, and that was my first song. Then it started coming a little bit easier, but it's never been easy. I've always had a struggle writing songs because it has to feel right to me before I can even bother to go any further with it.
Well, I mean, you could say if it comes too easily, you're probably not doing it right, you know? So
it seems it comes so easy to other people, but maybe I just don't know their process. But yeah. I know for me, I know what works for me, and it's just, you know, if I have an idea, I try to put it down somewhere. If I have a little snippet of lyric or something, I write it down, and maybe I'll come back to that stuff years, months later. And just when I'm like, okay, I've got this basic idea, do I have anything I can use? And I'll go back and look at things. And this album I just finished making here last year is like that. There's stuff on there, there's snippets of it that may go back 5, 10, 15 years. Mm. But it was put together and structured up, you know, and built into songs in the past year.
So fast forward, and I mean, you were living in Cleveland. So were you aware of this guy, Crocus Behemoth?
I knew about Crocus as a columnist, and that's how I knew of him at that time, yes.
So did you hear about Rocket from the Tombs before you joined Rocket from the Tombs?
I did not. I might have seen something about them in passing in the paper, because David did, Crocus did have, I heard about them in the paper because Crocus did have a column, and when he was doing something, he would announce it, but I never saw them perform. It wasn't until Peter approached me in fall of 1974 and asked me to come down and audition that he explained to me, you know, well, we've got this band with this guy Crocus, and he's got all these songs, we've been working together, and we want to try to take it to the next level.
See, that's interesting, because I don't think David would ever use the word audition. I'm not sure that David's actually considering that he's ever had anybody for an audition. So how did it feel walking into that rehearsal room feeling like you were being auditioned?
Well, I was asked to join, and I considered it an audition because I didn't know, except for, I only vaguely knew Peter. I mean, I knew him as a local musician. I had seen him play. He would come to Mirror Show. He's with him and his wife, Charlotte, were big fans of Mirrors. And they, in fact, I think Charlotte herself was probably at every show we did in that at that time. And I only knew him that way. And when he approached me, I wasn't really sure, because he said, well, I got these, you know, I got these two rock and roll kids, man, they're going to really, you know, they're really like rock guys. And I've got, and this guy Crocus, he's got these great songs, and we've been, you know, we really got something going here, and we want you to come and play bass. And so I wasn't sure what I was getting into. So I go up there, and I considered it an audition. No one ever said you passed the audition. No one ever said you're in the band. It just sort of like, okay, I'll see you next Saturday.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, see you next time.
So can you, do you have any recollections of that first time in the
rehearsal? Oh, yes, I do. I remember walking in there and meeting Cheetah for the first time.
How did that go?
Oh, it was great. It was great. The first thing I remember having our instruments on, and we sort of look at each other, and he goes, okay, what are we going to do? You know, what do you know? You know, and I said, I don't know. What do you know? He goes, oh, you know any Kiss? And he starts playing Black Diamond. Of all the Kiss songs, that's probably the one I kind of knew. So we just started messing around with that for a little bit, and it was going okay, you know. Then I said, oh, you know, do you know Foggy Notion, or, you know, Waiting for the Man or something by the Velvets? And he goes, oh, yeah, you know. And I just remember him and I playing a little bit, maybe for half an hour, just the two of us. And it was like, yeah, boy, Peter was right. These guys do rock, you know. And then Peter and David were there, and we ran through a few songs. I think the first song of Rocks for the Tombs that they showed me was So Cold. And I just thought to myself, okay, I know this song. I know how to play this song. I like this song. Let's do this. And I do believe that the first day that we played, and I may be wrong because it might have been a couple of days later, but that was one of the first songs that stuck out to me. And I said, wow. Then it was 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, and I was like, oh, shit, I have to be in this band. Those two songs right there just knocked me for a loop right from the get-go. It was like, these guys are serious. This is serious stuff.
I flew off early in the haze of dawn, in a metal dragon lost in time. The skimming waves of an underground sea, with some kind of dream world fantasy.
I mean, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, it has become a legend, really and truly, but I still can't quite fathom how the musicians would have taken that instrumental, you know, about two-thirds of the way through or whatever, and it sounds, somebody quoted about the new Perubu album, it sounds like they're angry at the music for existing, and I think that's a perfect description for Rocket from the Tombs, you know? So just explain the rehearsal room mood, and I mean, was it must have been so exhilarating.
It was. I, you know, there's all this, like you say, tension that everyone feels in the music. I didn't feel any tension when we were playing it in those days. You know, we were just all on this road of discovery at that time. That was that early time when we were working towards making the MMS tape. We were on this road to discovery, and it was just, you couldn't wait, speaking for me on this, couldn't wait to get up there and start playing. And, you know, there were new songs coming in, there were new ideas coming in, there was so much to work on. It was, it consumed, at that time in my life, I don't even remember, I know I had a job somewhere, but I can't remember what it was. You know, because I had to pay rent and things like that. So, but I can't even remember what the job I had was at the time. I was just so involved in when's the next rehearsal, when are we going to do some shows. You know, that period of time, the fall of 74 through the winter, was just, wow. It was magical.
Rocket that David says there was like five rehearsals a week.
It seemed there was nothing, we had nothing else. None of us, as far as I know, had anything else really going on. And yes, we would seem to be there every day. I know that when, afterwards in 1976, when I moved to Connecticut and I started my own band, when I started Saucers, that's the first thing I did with those guys was I said, you know, we have got to get up here and just practice. And we practiced every day for at least a couple hours in the early, you know, starting out. And I learned that from being in Rocket, was that if you're going to do this, you just got to get up there and do it and do it and do it and do it and do it, you know, until you feel you're ready to, you know, get it out there.
So David's put on the Rocket from the Tombs page on Ubu Projects that it was like a band of two halves. You had the adults and the kids. And I'm presuming he means you were in the adult section. How would you sum up the band atmosphere? Because you always come across as very, almost quiet, really, in comparison, and quite serious in comparison. So how did you get on with those vivacious, if for want of a better word, characters that were in the band?
It was my first meeting of David, Cheetah, and Johnny. And I vaguely knew Peter, but shortly after that, I moved in with Peter and Charlotte. So really, I was spending pretty much 24 hours a day with Peter. He turned 18, I think, the night we started the recordings for the MS tape. I turned 22. So even though it was only like 3 or 4 years difference, it seemed like, he's like this young kid who's just like really just let's go for, everything was on 11.
Yeah.
And ready to go all the time. And that enthusiasm would wash into you, too. You would go, all right, let's go. Let's do this stuff. When we weren't rehearsing, we weren't really hanging around that much. We didn't hang out. Yeah. None of us really hung out. I spent time with Peter because I lived in the same apartment with him. But there wasn't a real sense of like we're all, it wasn't like everybody living in a house together kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the energy and everything was in the rehearsal studio. Mm. And it was all focused at that time. And I loved it. I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. I learned so much in that 11 to 14 months that I still to this day use.
So that infamous final gig, there's one report that Cheetah was on his back for the entire performance on the stage, and David only remembers it being like maybe half a song or something, and he says then he got up.
On the television show, Cheetah he fell over at the beginning of the set.
Yeah.
He didn't spend the entire night on the floor.
No.
But there was a moment I do remember. In fact, there's that one picture of all of us across the stage like that. And I think that might have been after, because everybody sort of got this look on their face like, what's going to happen next? But I do remember looking over and I'm like, oh, Cheetah's on his back. What's up with that? And but after that, he recovered. And there's recordings of that show, and it wasn't a disaster.
Yeah.
There's some good stuff on there.
Yes,
that has kind of become kind of legend. But no, I don't remember being on his back either for anything but a short period of time.
Yeah. So I mean, those live recordings—they were what kept the Rocket from the Tombs name alive. They just became this underground sensation, and you all got back together, I think, in 2003.
Yes.
For the Day the Earth Met Rocket from the Tombs album release. Mm-hmm. How was that?
It was very strange.
What were the differences that you, maybe not even at the time, but on reflection, have been able to identify? Was Cheetah a little bit calmer? Was David a little less bossy?
No, but it didn't matter. It was back with the same people. You had that feeling when we got back together, you had that feeling that we all knew each other, whether we had seen each other yesterday or 10 years previous. We all understood what we were there for. As we went along, maybe that kind of changed, but I was very happy to be working with him again. I was very happy to be playing that music again, and it felt right. It felt great. But also, it was under the caveat that David had said, almost for the first day when we got together, the three of us, and talking, I think one of the first things David said was, don't expect this to last. And I took that to heart. And I thought, okay, well, then let's make the most of what we've got.
Yeah.
I don't think we accomplished that, but we sure did a lot. I wish, you know, I think we were capable of more, but I understand why that didn't happen.
Came Barfly and Black Record. You were telling me the other day that you're very proud of Barfly. You've been listening to it a lot recently.
Yes, I have, and I am. I've always liked that record. I mean, I didn't like reception it got. You know, there were a lot of people that just said, "Oh, it's another Perubu record," and it's not. It's not even. I can't even put into words how wrong that assumption is.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, but it definitely wasn't the day the Earth met Rocket from the Tombs, or even Rocket Redux for that matter. That was the band 25 years ago. This was the band then. And that record has great claims with great songwriting on it. And yes, it you know, if you play one against the other, you're gonna go, okay, it's different, but it's still the same band.
Because you had all aged that much and learned different things and been playing with different bands.
I agree. I think a lot of critics, they want to judge you on what you've done previously. So if you're not giving them something that they can relate to what you've done, they're not going to be able to look at it as objectively as you can, because you're trying to show people, I do this, but yeah, I also do this, and I do this, and I can do that, and I can do that too. is all, don't, you know, we're not here to be pigeonholed into, will you do that?
I think it was the tour of Barfly where David was hospitalized and missed half the European tour.
Well, I had seen him a couple of months previously when we rehearsed in Cleveland. And he had had the thing on his face, and we had remarked, you know, that looks pretty serious there. Yeah, I'm going to go get it looked at. And then came the time to tour. I got on a plane here in Indianapolis and flew to Newark. When I landed in Newark, Steve was waiting for me at the gate, and he goes, David's sick. David's in the hospital. It's really serious. We don't know what's going to happen. He may die. Mm. And he goes, we can turn around and go home now, or we can get on the plane and go over there and figure it out. And I said, let's get on the plane and go. And everyone else did too. Yeah. We ended up, I remember that was what I called the 10 days in Berlin.
Yeah.
And we stayed at that hostel, the promoter, and we had no money. We had nothing. We had to return the van. We had to drive to, what was it, Antwerp?
Yeah.
They had the merch at the first show, which had, of course, they canceled the early show, so we had to drive up there, which was an overnight drive, pick up the merch, overnight drive back. I remember, I think we stayed in Dusseldorf. I forget where the town was, but we showed up at like 4 in the morning at this hostel, and there's nobody there. It was like pulling up to a farmhouse, and we're like, should we knock on the door? Should we blow the horn? And finally, we found someone to let us in and got some sleep. But then we came back and we were in that hostel. We had no money. The promoter, I guess, had fronted us some euros, so we at least had some day-to-day to keep us going. And I think we were only getting, I think we were getting daily updates from you and everything, but we still just didn't know, but we were just all under the, well, we're going to do this. He's going to be all right. He's going to come. And finally, like you said, we drove to Paris. And we did the abbreviated shows, and it was heroic on his part.
I'd only known David for a couple of years at that point. I'd never seen him in this mode, but I actually had him at one point. He was in the wheelchair waving his stick saying, I will not let my brothers down, while I ran him out the hospital in his hospital gown.
I don't like cannibalism.
Over to stay with you and Claude, and you wrote some of the Black Record together.
Right here in this room, Black Record is a fantastic record. I love that record, yeah. In fact, right here, if I turn this chair around where I am right here, right this spot was where the bass parts were recorded.
Yeah.
Spooky.
Yeah.
And I remember working down here with David on that stuff and thinking to myself, this is that band. This is the band right here. This is what we started to be, and this is what we are. And
yeah,
here we are 30, 40 years later, and we are what we wanted to be.
And then you went out.
It's a very good feeling.
The tour of that album was insanely good. Insanely good every single night without fail. I think that
it was. There were some good times.
Amazing, with Gary and Buddy as well on guitars. I mean, it was, and the thing was, it wasn't really quite so angry anymore. It was like proper, like you'd been playing it for years every night and were completely note perfect.
No, a lot of that goes back to Berlin, because we were there for those 10 days with nothing to do, of the four of us, and we had the opportunity every other day to go to this rehearsal studio and just play the songs, just the four of us, and play. And that, I think, formed that band into a unit. And you're right, I love playing with Richard and Cheetah too. I mean, there's just, I remember so many nights being on stage and looking to my left and seeing Cheetah and David, looking to my right and seeing Richard like right here, like grabbed by his shoulder. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm playing with some of the most, you know, revered musicians of this era. This is fantastic. And then I got to say to myself, well, wait a minute, that's me too. I have to do that. Wait, I'm supposed to be doing something here.
Absolutely.
So there were some great, great shows. I can't ever remember being on stage and not wanting to be there except once. What you were talking about earlier was the final Rocket from the Tomb show of the original era, when it was just one person left, walked off the stage, another walked off the stage, until it was just almost like no one there.
Yeah.
And it was really sad. It was sad. It was just so sad. You knew it was coming. I mean, we could tell it was coming, but just to have it end like that was just really...
We haven't talked about Pere Ubu at all, rightly so, but you are a Pere Ubu fan.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, how...
I just got the new live album, which, by the way, is absolutely killer. I had it on, you may know Chuck Bowie.
Oh, yeah.
Chuck stopped by. He was on his way back from Florida. He's going back to Chicago. So he stopped by, and we had dinner last week. And I put on the album, and it was in the house, and we're out on the porch. But all of a sudden, you can hear David speaking.
Yeah.
And it was like he was in the room. It was just, it was like my ears picked up. I said, oh. What's going on? When I had to go back into the room, he was giving the intro to Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
And then they started playing the song, and I just had to stand there and stare at the stereo. It was just fantastic. It is a bravo. But I think you had mentioned somewhere where record companies don't like live albums from bands, but here is a band that needs to have live albums, because the performance of those songs can take off and take so many different, go so many different places.
Yeah.
If you let them, and just some of the but Michelle's playing on the Mayor's album.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Totally. Leading the band through things.
I came across one of the original accounts books from a European tour in the 80s. And I wanted to ask you, you've been in several bands now. Is the David Thomas approach unusual in as much as he is so fastidious with the business side of things, the accounts, the per diems, the payouts and all that sort of thing? I mean, for one thing, everyone gets an even split of the profits from tours, et cetera, et cetera. Is that unusual in a band?
You know, it's hard for me to say, because I studied at his knee. You know, the way I run my bands and things like that, I learned from him. I've always, the band makes money after we pay our expenses, which would be our rehearsal space and sometimes things like that. If we had any money, we always split it up evenly between band members. When it came time to make records and things like that, well, you know, songwriting credits, that's up to the songwriter, you know. But if we were out working as a band, I learned from his model. And after working with Rocket in the last 15 years with the tour books and that, I never got that precise with it. We're handing out, here's your tour book. Every day you knew where you had to be and what time and everything. But I did have all of that worked out before we went out on tour, and everybody understood, you know, we got to be here, we got to be there, this is how long it takes to get there, so we got to get up and get going at this time. The term truck time
has
probably become almost universal with any band I've been involved with. I got Simply Saucer saying it, you know, truck time.
What
is truck time, Craig?
And truck time is in the truck, not outside the truck, the truck.
Not coming downstairs, not sitting in the lobby. Truck time is your ass in the seat.
Truck.
Yes, absolutely. And I learned that from David. I have toured with some other people that have been a lot looser, and you know, we've paid for it.
Yeah.
I remember, I can think of an incident with when I was working with the Gizmos. In fact, it's one of the reasons that wanted to stop working with them, was that they just took it too lackadaisically, and it caused problems.
Yeah.
And why do you want to why do you need more problems when you're already away from home and off your regular schedule and everything?
Yeah.
You know, why add something that's totally unnecessary?
Well, and like, also it's the easiest way to lose money is to not be organized. But I mean, I know some people resent perhaps the rigidness of the rules and all that sort of thing.
Oh,
but
of course.
I mean, you know, it's not very rock and roll, is it, kind of thing? But it's hard work.
You know, it does work, and yes, this is rock and roll and stuff like that, but it's also a life, you know, it's your livelihood.
Yeah.
It's David's livelihood. And when you're dawdling, you're taking money out of someone's pocket.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, if that's too capitalist for you, and that's too much, that's like too much of a bad vibe, man, well, maybe you're not in the right band. But
yeah.
Boy, every book I've been reading lately about, from Howl and Wolf to Elvis Costello, you know, you've got to have some kind of freaking organization, or else it's just going to be chaos. And when it's chaos, then it's nothing.
And when's the Craig Bell biography going to happen?
This is part of it right here. I'm just sort of throwing it all out there. I'm not going to write it. I want somebody else to write it.
Okay.
So I'm just putting all the information out there for them. They can go find it. You know, it's all there. I'm not going to write a book because then I'd have to tell the truth, and I don't want to do that.
Speak, just comply. Wish my hair seems more divine.